Okay, what I'm going to be doing is talking about two technologies oftentimes not discussed in the same sentence. Trap cropping is oftentimes referred to as kind of an alternative management method. Biotechnology is thought about perhaps the technology of the future. Let's see. Give an outline. Basically, I'll do some definition of terms, give some examples of individual technologies, then combining the technologies, and then finish up with some points to ponder. In 1991, Heikki Hokkanen wrote an annual review article giving a very good format for the concept of trap cropping, which he defined as plant stands grown to attract insects or other organisms like nematodes to protect the target crops by preventing the pests from reaching the crop or concentrating them in a certain part of the field where they can be economically destroyed. This gave a really good conceptual framework for the idea of trap cropping. The standard definition that Heikki used has this key concept in it, which is basically involves differential pest preference between the plant species, that is the plants that function as a trap crop, and then the plants that are to be protected, which I'd refer to as the cash crops. However, there are some limitations to this definition, because the differential preference is really not the key concept utilized in many examples of what we would call trap cropping. For example, the same species of plants that serve as a trap crop can also be used as the crop to be protected if it is grown in a particular spatial or temporal manner or with a particular added trait. So in 2006, Francisco Benitez Perez, co-author on this paper, and I published a paper in the Annual Review of Entomology, where we gave a different twist to the definition of trap crop. We used much of what Heikki had also talked about, but we said that these are plant stands that are deployed to attract, intercept, retain, and or reduce targeted insects or the pathogens that they vector in order to reduce the damage. So we use two main concepts in here, that is the inherent characteristics of the trap crop as well as how they are deployed. So we had two modalities of trap cropping: the plant characteristics, that is how attractive is the plant and what are its characteristics for resistance, for example, and then how is it deployed in the field. To give an example, this is one that's commonly thought of. This would be trap cropping using perimeter trap crops. For example, Colorado potato beetle would overwinter in the borders, and early on in the season, if they will come in and it will colonize these border rows of potatoes. So if you can plant the potatoes a little bit earlier, the border rows at least, the insects will tend to congregate on there. And then you could spray them with an insecticide or do something else like that. There's also examples where it's been used with pepper maggot, using border rows of hot cherry peppers, or papaya fruit fly, where you plant some additional borders of papaya trees and then just basically use those and sacrifice those. But in the in plant characteristics, when we look at that, there's a couple of good examples, I think, of what I call conventional trap cropping and how it's used. The first one is a long one with Vern Stern back in the 60s, using alfalfa as a trap crop for cotton over here. Ligus goes to alfalfa. It can do some damage to alfalfa, but alfalfa is a relatively low-value crop. So what growers were trying to do is to harvest the alfalfa, say, in strips, so it always have a habitat for the ligus bug and prevent them from moving over to the higher-value cotton. Another example is using very attractive varieties of squash to manage the squash bugs or the cucumber beetles. So you'd have maybe a row of very, very attractive squash plants, and then the insects would tend to congregate there. So this is what I'd call conventional trap cropping. Genetic engineering can also be done for trap cropping, and there's two different types of that I would refer to. One is using engineering the plants to be, say, insect resistant, which I would call, say, dead end trap crops. So the insects would tend to go to these trap crops, colonize them, at least lay their eggs on them, but the larvae, the offspring, could not survive. And something like BT plants could be considered dead end trap crops. There's also the possibility of having semiochemical plants that are producing semiochemicals that would disrupt mating or encourage natural enemies or encourage pest avoidance. These are things, I think, for the future, but these, I think, are also being used now. Another totally different concept is using plants resistant to insect-transmitted viruses, and those can be used for trap cropping. And a good example of that is with papaya ring spot virus. Papaya ring spot virus is transmitted by aphids in a non-circulative and non-persistent manner. That is, the aphids can just pick up the virus in a matter of seconds and then fly off to another plant and then transmit that. And in Hawaii, the papaya ring spot virus has been very devastating to the papaya crop over in Hawaii. There were about 58 million pounds of papaya produced in Hawaii in 92, but when papaya ring spot virus came in, it knocked that down to 24 million. So this is a devastating disease. Dennis Gonzalez, a colleague of mine at Cornell for a number of years, was able to develop transgenic papaya using the coat protein method to make the papaya resistant to papaya ring spot virus. This is a healthy plant. This is a diseased plant. And growers are always very, very clever people. So when growers in Hawaii start adopting this, and about 50% of the papaya in Hawaii is transgenic to be resistant to papaya ring spot virus. And that's for, say, direct control of the virus. But a lot of growers also have been able to plant border rows of papaya ring spot virus papaya right around their non-GM papaya. So as the insects come in from an infected area, they will tend to land on the genetically engineered papaya here and basically cleanse themselves of the virus and before they move into the center part of the field. And this, I think, is a very good way for them to use it as a trap crop because it allows them to produce genetically engineered papaya around the perimeter, but also non-GM papaya in the middle. And the non-GM papaya can go for the high-value Hawaiian market where they don't allow GM papaya at this time. Another example would be BT plants for Colorado potato beetle. And as I mentioned before, the Colorado potato beetle tends to overwinter in the woods, and then as it comes in, if it lands on border rows of BT potatoes, then when the eggs hatch into larvae, the larvae are toast. Another way of looking at this is something that we've done with diamondback moth, and we've been using the trap crop Indian mustard shown here. And this is the diamondback moth larvae. Indian mustard has been recommended as a trap crop for diamondback moth for a number of years because diamondback moth love it. They actually lay maybe 10, 15 times the number of eggs on it than most crucifer cash crops like cauliflower or cabbage. However, the problem is that diamondback moth develops high populations on Indian mustard, and then it may spill over to the cash crop. So you're actually exacerbating the problem. We ran tests to evaluate whether BT Indian mustard, a dead-end trap crop, would be a more effective trap crop than regular Indian mustard. So we ran these studies using large cages in the greenhouse because we're located in upstate New York and it gets a little cold up there to run long-term trials. So what we did is we had in the cages here, we would have individual cages, we'd have 50 plants, 40 cabbage plants in the middle of the cage, and then surrounded by 10 Indian mustard, either BT or non-BT Indian mustard. And then we would place diamondback moth adults into the cages and allow them to lay eggs and develop on the plants and complete three generations. And then we would evaluate the number of eggs and larvae for each generation. And the results are quite striking. In the first generation, the oviposition on BT Indian mustard and non-BT Indian mustard was the same, you know, because there was the insects couldn't really detect it. But survival on the BT Indian mustard was very low, resulting in a lower diamondback moth population in the cage for the second generation. Then by the third generation, there were very large differences between treatments. For example, in the cages with BT Indian mustard as a trap crop, we had 2.45 diamondback moth larvae per cabbage plant, with the regular Indian mustard, 39. Maybe a better way of looking at it is to show right here. This is what it looks like with the traditional Indian mustard. This is what it looks like with BT Indian mustard. So I'm going to finish with points to ponder. Of the over 200 studies on traditional trap cropping, only a few are implemented to some degree. But we think that biotechnology can be used to enhance the potential for trap cropping by creating what I call dead-end trap crops, or plants that resist the spread of plant pathogens like papaya ring spot virus, or in the future perhaps plants that can attract natural enemies or produce semiochemicals to suppress insects. So I'd like to end by saying I think biotechnology and trap cropping can play well together in the sandbox. And these are acknowledgments with the people who have worked on this concept. Thank you very much. Yes.
How would it play with resistance management protocols if you're attracting any animals to a resistant crop?
Well, if you're concentrating, sure. The question is, how would this play for resistance management? And I think each situation would be different. If you are attracting, for example, the insects for Colorado potato beetle to come to the border rows where the BT plants are, you've got a tremendous refuge also of the non-BT plants out there as well. And you could also use something else or rotate this from year to year. There's lots of different options, but it depends on the individual system.